I'm your host, Aaron Rittmaster. Welcome to the Man Cave, where joining me tonight to record Diz Dad's podcast number 384 for Sunday, March 27th, 2016, are Bob Chavez.
Good evening, everybody.
Justin West.
Welcome to our version of March Madness.
And David Jort.
Hey, good evening.
Now, tonight, we're going to be talking Scotch whiskey in what may be the first in a series of, what we'll call boozecast shows, I guess. But before we get into that discussion, I want to take a moment to remind you that the Diz Dads podcast is now sponsored by Fantastic Memories Travel and its Mouse Master Travel Group. The Mouse Master Travel Group focuses on Disney destination vacations, and Mouse Master agents would love to take care of the stressful parts of vacation planning so you can focus on fun. Check them out at mousemastertravel.com. So tonight we're turning our attention to Scotch whiskey. Why would we be talking Scotch whiskey? Well, first I have to ask you, why not? It is an awesome spirit. But it comes out of a couple of things. Number one is me personally, I happen to be a big fan of Scotch. It's one of my favorite adult beverages. And recently, as we were recording a beer cast, it sort of came up that Scotch and beer sort of start out with the same basic stuff, right, David?
Yeah, so, any whiskey, they make a mash, right? Just like you do with beer. You put a bunch of grain in some water, you heat it up, and then you throw yeast in it, and you get the alcohol out. Except, with whiskey, you do what?
Well, there are a couple of things about Scotch in particular that you do that's a little different. The first is, and we're here focusing specifically on what's referred to as single malt Scotch. So the first thing about that is that means that it's coming from just a single grain, right? It's being made from barley, and you're not going to toss hops in like you do for beer. You're going to stop before you get tiny hops. And you're going to do that sort of initial mash with the barley and the yeast, and you get the alcohol, forming. But then you're going to distill it. And so just like you make brandy by distilling wine and concentrating the flavors, similarly, you start with the same basic stuff that you start with to make beer, but then you're going to distill it down. And in many cases, twice, and in some cases with Scotch, even three times, you're going to continue to refine and purify and distill down that product until what you end up with is a much higher alcohol content with very, very focused flavor.
Right. You get the alcohol off of the mash, distill it out, and then you're going to impart the flavor beyond that with barrel aging and such, which I'm sure you're going to get into. So,
right. Yeah, exactly. So once you've done the distillation process, you're going to put that resulting alcohol into an oak cask. And in order to be labeled as Scotch whiskey, that solution has to be in an oak cask for a minimum of 3 years and one day. That's Scottish law. So if you're going to call it Scotch whiskey, 3 years and a day in oak. Now, in practical terms, nobody drinks Scotch that's only been aged for 3 years and a day. It would be incredibly harsh. So that's the minimum. You can then do different things with it. And we'll talk about the kinds of different things you can do in just a little bit. But once you take the alcohol out of that cask initially, it's going to come out at about 60 to 63% alcohol, right? So like about 120 proof. But when it's bottled at sort of a standard alcohol by volume of 40 to 46%. So 80 to the high end. Geez, I guess 92 proof, although I don't think I've ever seen something at 92 proof in a standard shipping. You do now sometimes see Scotch being shipped at what they call cask strength, 120 proof. And when they do that, you're absolutely expected to add your own water and basically, you know, determine your own ABV. I would never recommend drinking, you know, undiluted cask strength scotch. It just wouldn't be very fun. Wouldn't be very enjoyable.
Save that for 140 proof bourbon.
There you go. Okay, so there's your kind of your basic, you know, chemistry lesson of scotch. Concentrated flavor, and you start with a rather harsh alcohol that you put in the oak casks. The oak casks help to mellow the harsh alcohol. And so the idea, at least, is that the longer you age, the more mellow it gets, although it doesn't always play so nicely. And that's why you're going to find that often scotch that's aged longer moves to different kinds of casks, both to impart some additional flavors, as we'll talk about with the scotch that Bob's going to be talking about with us tonight, or just moving it into another cask. So we're going to start with a couple of Speyside scotches. Bob, you want to talk a little bit about Speyside scotches and where they come from?
Well, as a matter of fact, I can do that. They come from the Speyside region. Actually got a history book, book of the history of scotches. I thought it would be nice to have a little bit of information, not just guessing and inferences. But so if it sounds like I'm reading, it's because I am. Speyside is located around the Spey River Valley in northeast Scotland, of which Speyside is a part. Once part of the Highlands, it is half of all Scottish distilleries. So big name brands as Cragmore, Glenfiddich, Glenlivet, and the Macallan, among others. Speyside whiskies are usually light and grassy, or rich and sweet with a good balance.
Okay, so
that's
right. So Speysides are, I think, a lot of times seen as sort of gateway scotches in much the same way we talk about gateway craft beers, because they do tend to have sort of brighter flavors, maybe a little bit closer to the flavors you would get out of an American bourbon.
Definitely a lot more mellow and a lot less harsh than some of the other scotches that are out there, that's for sure. I know that the Balvenie was one of the first quote-unquote good scotches that I've had, and I think that's what sold me on the value of good scotch, was just how good the Balvenie was to other types of scotch whiskeys.
Sure. I want to ask you to hang on just 1 second, because the Balvenie that you've chosen gives us an opportunity to talk about the multiple cask distilling, and I want to start with maybe the basic, you know, single cask or single type of cask distilling, which would come from David, who is enjoying a 15-year-old Glenfiddich tonight, which is also a Speyside malt.
That I am. And I'm actually, I don't know if you want to get into options to drink it or not.
Well, that's a good point. You might as well bring it up. So how do you like to drink your scotch, Dave?
I like whiskey neat most of the time. I did a little bit of experimenting this evening. And I got some whiskey stones recently.
Oh, okay.
For Christmas, actually. So I pulled those out, and I had one dram sitting on a few of those, and it's definitely not as cold as I would have thought. It's basically like drinking it neat.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about terminology and kind of why we're even talking about this. Traditionally, a sort of, you know, a Scotch traditionalist will say that you really ought to drink your Scotch neat, essentially at room temperature, but with sort of a splash of water in it, because that splash of water, and really it should just be like spring water, not distilled or mineral water, but just a dash of spring water kind of opens up the flavors a little bit. On the other hand, my philosophy is drink it the way you enjoy it. And right. So clearly, Dave, you know, you appreciate your booze a little cooler. For me in the summer, I like my scotch cold. Most of the rest of the time, I'll drink it, you know, just pour it out of the bottle into the glass. And then whiskey stones versus ice. Well, what's the benefit of a whiskey stone instead of ice?
Well, whiskey stone or a they do stainless steel balls or cubes also.
Right.
It doesn't melt. So you aren't imparting any water into the drink. You're just making it cold. It's almost the same as pulling a beer out, getting a frosted mug, and pouring the beer into the frosted mug. It's going to keep it colder longer without adding ice to it.
Right.
So that's cool. I'm sitting here with a few drinks in front of me. So I have the neat one. I have the one that I put on stones. And then I do... I blasphemer drinking bourbon a little bit this evening also. But I usually
that's
drink
more than
it.
Two fists, Dave. You're cheating.
I know. Well, I know. My bad. So, but I like bourbon both neat and then completely on the rocks, where it's three or four ice cubes and just let the water work its magic. So each different style of drinking imparts a different flavor profile with it. And I'm going to go back to beer here, and if you don't want me to, let me know. But, you know, most beer in this country, as you've noted earlier, is drank at a much cooler temperature than our European counterparts. As beer warms, I'm sure we all know this, the flavor profile changes. It's kind of the same with whiskey, where the colder you get, you're not going to get... It's going to be a different flavor profile. Not necessarily less, but a different flavor profile, especially if you put it on the rocks and you have it... on true ice, where the water is going to, ice is going to melt, there's going to be water there, it is going to release some different notes for you.
Okay, so talk for us specifically about the Glenfiddich that you're trying tonight.
Well, I am relatively new to the single malt world, never really jumped into it, still kind of stuck on beer and a little bit of bourbon here and there. As you said, this is kind of a really good gateway whiskey as opposed to beer. It's clean. It's not harsh. There's no harsh flavor to it. It's actually rather sweet compared to any American whiskey that you're going to get. Bourbon tends to be sweet. This also tends to be sweet, where I guess you have an Islay, right? So
right,
we're going to get to some of the crazier flavors that Scotch can offer, which is awesome in its own right. But this is it's and just to go kind of, you know, beer wise here, it's a nice clear kind of, I don't know, looks sort of like a really watery honey, right? And has
the colors that you're going to get from Scotch generally range from, you know, a few Scotches that are going to be completely clear, those are pretty rare, to Scotches that have a kind of a deep caramel color. By law, Scotch can only have three things in it. It can have water, it can have the barley malt, and it can have a particular plain caramel coloring that does not impart flavor.
Hmm.
And that's it.
Interesting.
So every other flavor that you get from the Scotch has to come either from the water that's used to make it or from the casks that are used to mature it.
Right, right. Which is why, as we move on, we're going to see the benefits of multiple cask aging.
Exactly.
But yeah, there's some sweet notes, some peppery notes in the nose. It's slightly smoky, not completely though. Now drinking it neat, I didn't really splash any water in it. I will now though. But it definitely has a harsh alcohol tone to it. Nothing more than any other whiskey, but the flavor's a lot brighter. It's a lot spicier. I don't know if it's kind of like an allspice or like a nutmeg maybe. But that, and then you still have some of those caramel flavors that you're going to get from whiskey, right? So it's pretty smooth at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a really clean flavor, basically. It's going to, mm-hmm. If there's a criticism of it, it would be that it's fairly, you know, limited range of notes there.
Right.
It's mm-hmm. consistent, it's clean, but not terribly complex.
Right, and it's kind of like the, I can't believe it, it's like the Bud Light of
not
the
quite
Scotch
Bud
world.
Light. But,
I know, but...
But yeah, I know what you're saying.
Actually, that's actually a horrible, horrible statement.
Yeah,
like,
really
Cutty Sark and Chivas is the Bud Light.
Right.
And
right.
Budweiser.
Let's try this. Maybe it's sort of the pale ale instead of the triple.
I'm with you. I agree with that.
All right.
Cut all that other stuff out.
Now, we did have another Speyside here, and that's the one that Bob is drinking, and he mentioned it earlier. It's a Balvenie Doublewood, and the Balvenie Doublewood is a 12-year-old scotch, so it's actually not aged as long as the Glenfiddich that Dave is drinking, but it does have a unique difference as compared to the Glenfiddich. The Glenfiddich is aged in oak casks, for the entire length of its 15-year aging. The Balvenie starts in an oak cask because that's the law, it has to, but then later in its maturation process, it's moved into a European oak cask that had previously been used for sherry. So you're going to get some of that complexity and some of the flavor from the sherry that leaches into the maturing whiskey. So, Bob, talk a little bit about that 12-year-old Doublewood Balvenie.
Okay. I like my story about when I first had this glass of scotch. My father bought me the bottle for Christmas however many years ago, and it sat in my refrigerator for almost a year. Just because I never had a reason to open it. You know, there wasn't anybody over, there wasn't any scotch drinkers, and I hadn't had any. I opened it one night because it was a Friday night. Why not? And I don't have a whiskey vocabulary or scotch vocabulary, but I took a sip, and it was just warm. It's a smooth, delicious, warm scotch. But after that first, just like I said, warm, it really does have just a little bit more in there than a lot of the scotches I've had since then. Now, it took me a while to figure out what that little bit more was, and it was from the secondary aging. You can a little bit pull out some of that cherry flavor. But the first time I had it, I didn't know what I was tasting other than delicious nectar of the gods.
So this is a good example of, you know, the Speyside sort of style tends to be, as Dave had described, fairly straightforward, clean taste. One of the ways to add complexity is to add the flavor that borrowed, essentially, from the used sherry cask. And you get those extra fruit flavors, the grapes or raisin flavors that might come from sherry. Really nice complexity that comes without having to age a lot longer. And the benefit of that is that it helps make it a little more affordable. I mean, we haven't really talked about this issue yet, and maybe we'll circle around to it specifically at the end, but it's a consideration. It's something that kind of made it take a little while for us to decide to go ahead and do the show and a little while to figure out the best way to structure it because, you know, it's not like you can go. I mean, I was complaining a couple of weeks ago when we did the beer cast about the fact that the six-pack of, you know, Grapefruit Sculpin was going to cost me $15. And, you know, any one of these bottles of scotch is considerably more expensive.
That's definite. That's why I'm so thrilled that my parents and in-laws aren't upset about getting me alcohol for Christmas. So now I get a bottle of booze every year that I get to hold on to. So I just have to decide which one it's going to be for that year.
There you go.
Blame this hold on to thing.
That's when you have a little bit at a time and not the whole bottle at once.
Well, that actually, that's a good point. You know, I mean, you can't, I hate to put it in these terms, but you do kind of amortize your scotch, right? I mean, you know, when you get a six pack of beer, it's not going to last that long. I've been known, especially, it seems like the more I like the bottle, I start to sort of get really stingy with it because I want to, you know, save it and drink it in smaller bits, trying to preserve it.
That's something that I think you and I share. So, but specifically, to bring it back to the Balvenie in particular, I'm with David in that I like it neat most of the time. But I got the Whiskey Stones for Christmas as well. And I don't want to say that because it's colder, it's easier to drink or more palatable, but I do find that I enjoy it a little bit more if it's not quite at room temperature, but just a little bit cooler. And again, if somebody else likes it room temperature or with water, it's yours. Drink it how you want. Don't drink it how somebody says you're supposed to. Yep. That's just my opinion.
No, I agree 100%. So those were the two Speysides, and we're going to get to sort of the next region, because we had Justin who picked up a bottle of Glenmorangie, which is from another region entirely. If the first two were Speysides, Glenmorangie is a Highlands malt. And actually, Bob, if you have your... if you have your book handy, what does it tell you about Highlands malts?
It says that the Highlands is divided into four subregions. Northern Highland whiskies are full, sweet, and rich. Southern Highland whiskies are lighter, drier, and fruitier. Eastern Highland whiskies are dry and fruity. Western Highland whiskies are peaty and smoky.
Okay, so... one of the things about the Highlands is that although there are relatively few distilleries left in the Highlands, there is, as compared to Speyside, there's considerable variety among the Highlands. The Glenmorangie that Justin bought is a Northern Highland whiskey, so going to have a little more complexity and a little more of the... I think I've seen a couple of reviewers refer to it as being spirited. So, Justin, tell us about the flavors that you're getting from the 10-year Glenmorangie.
Okay, well, I'll start by first saying that Whiskey Stones must have been the Christmas present of the year because I myself got a set. I'll just... throw this out there. I'm a scotch novice. My extent of drinking scotch has mostly been nobody shoot me here, but shooting, you know, shots of scotch at the family reunion every year. So not really enjoying it, and usually it's been after, you know, maybe double-digit beers. So the taste buds, you know, maybe not on their high note at that point. But so I'm coming into this pretty fresh without much experience. The my previous scotch drinking has been Dewars, you know, blended. Don't like it. I could tell you that much. But... I put the Whiskey Stones on this. I did a little splash of water. It's actually very pleasant. It's not inducing any mouth watering or anything like that. It's kind of got a fruity floral smell to it, and it it tastes pretty dang smooth. It's got a little bit of a vanilla tone to it on the tongue, and then the after taste a little bit. I get the citrus notes a bit, a little bit of like orange peel maybe.
Interesting. And so this is, as we were saying, you know, with the Highlands, all of these flavors are coming from really environmental contributions, right? This, you're not adding anything to the mash. That would be against the law, literally. So you're getting a bit of peat from the, that's just more present there in the Highlands. And you're getting all of this really mostly from the combination of the Highlands water and the particular oak casks that they're using. And it's interesting to me that you get such complexity when it's only a 10-year-old product, as compared to the 15-year-old Glenfiddich. And I almost wonder whether in this case, pulling it out of the casks a little sooner sort of prevents some of these nice notes that you're talking about from getting sort of mellowed out of the liquor.
Yeah, very much could be. I was reading a little bit about it, and it says it's aged in bourbon barrels at some point.
Yeah.
So maybe it just picks that up. Whatever the wood they use, maybe I don't know. Like I said, I'm real new to this, so.
The book can contribute to the aging process, actually. Apparently, I'm going to mispronounce it, and I apologize. Glenmorangie, is that what you said?
Morangie,
sorry. It owns a forest in the Ozark Mountains in Missouri, and the casks are leased to Jack Daniels for 4 years for aging bourbon before they go to the Glenmorangie folks. So that's probably... I'm assuming what's contributing to.
So they break them in over at Jack Daniels.
Yeah. That was one of the funnier tours I've ever been on, just FYI.
Okay.
It's a story for another day, but remind me.
Okay, we will. We'll let you forget that at all.
Yeah.
So that's the Highland, and like I said, there's a lot of variety from the Highland malts, and really there's a lot of variety within Glenmorangie. Glenmorangie does some really interesting stuff. We could probably pretty easily do a whole show on Glenmorangie, partially, I mean, I admit, I'm partial to it. There are a couple that I've had recently from them that have just been amazing. And so I'm kind of constantly on the lookout for something new, because they seem to be at the forefront of doing some more experimental things. They've been doing we've talked about how some of the brewers do these special sort of brewer editions, right, where they do a one-off beer. Glenmorangie does that kind of thing with their scotches. They'll come up with a special recipe for the year, and they do two or three of these sort of distillers bottlings. And they did one a couple of years ago called Companta, which may be the best thing I've ever put in my mouth. It was a sad day when that bottle finally went dry.
Oh, so let me ask this, and which is kind of an overarching question for scotch in general. It amazes me how they're looking 10, 12, 15, 20 years down the road. When that thing goes into a cask to start, it's not hitting shelves for 10 years.
Yep.
Minimum.
Yep. It's pretty amazing. Now, so, one thing to realize, too, though, is, and we talked about this, maybe only tangentially at the beginning, when a scotch is referred to as single malt, that means it comes from a single distiller. That doesn't mean it comes from a single cask. Now, there will be some bottlings that say that they're single cask bottlings, but there's actually a considerable amount of blending that happens in a Scotch distillery, even if it's right. a single malt. Because what they're right. doing is trying to balance the final bottling to get a consistent product. They're just doing it from only the product that they themselves distill.
Well, that and the whole single malt reference, like you made, was it is a single, it's just barley. That's it.
Right.
It's
right.
not like, it's not like you go to Jack Daniels and they tell you that they put a bunch of corn in everything and it's barley and everything else.
Right. And it's true that blended whiskey often has, a blended Scotch whiskey might have other grain alcohol added into it. Whereas a single malt will only have alcohol that's distilled from barley. But I guess what I'm getting at is that's one of the ways that they can create such variation in these things like these, you know, private edition bottlings that Glenmorangie does, or some of the variations that you'll see from the other distilleries as well, even if it's all coming from the same kinds of aging barrels and similar ages, they can still get some very distinctly different flavors just by the way that they blend their own casks. All right, so I happen to be drinking the 16-year-old Lagavulin, which is an Islay Scotch. Islays are, they tend to be the most polarizing Scotches. You either love them or hate them. I think that they're definitely, there are very few people that I know who start with an Islay or who, you know, haven't had Scotch much before, start with an Islay and say, ooh, that's my drink. I know it wasn't for me. You know, the first time I had Lagavulin, I thought, why would anybody drink this? But now it's one of my favorites. The big difference is that these Islays are going to be much more sort of stronger flavors, and you get stronger smells too. It's peaty and smoky, a lot of salinity in it. And all of those things have a tendency to create a bit more complex flavor palette because, you know, you get different things that come through sort of the longer. I mean, I it's hard to drink Lagavulin and, you know, sit and chat because I have a tendency to kind of want to let it linger in my mouth because the flavor changes as it sits on your tongue.
Right.
Lots of really complex flavors that kind of change as you go. And you can smell it right up front. I mean, the iodine comes through, and a lot of people, as soon as they smell that iodine, they're like, there's no way I'm drinking that. Turns them off immediately. But, you know, once you get a little bit more familiar with the initial flavor palette of Scotch, I think that you get more sensitive to and more interested in the complexity that you get from, you know, these Islays that are going to be, you know, more, trying to find the word, right? Because it's not really more flavorful. I mean, the Macallan is wonderfully flavorful. I guess it's different. More distinctive flavor.
Yeah. Different, distinctive. It's just, it's like an offshoot. I don't know.
Yeah, and you know, there are only 8 distilleries left in the Islay region. So, you know, if you find these, I mean, the ones you're going to find in liquor stores most commonly, Lagavulin and Laphroaig are the ones you're going to see, you know, most often. Bowmore is starting to show up more often, and Ardbeg is starting to show up more often. And then the Kolila shows up too. There, you know, the other three are pretty rare on regular liquor store shelves. I don't know. I mean, you got to keep watching because I think I've noticed recently, even just in the last few months, a lot more variety of Scotch on liquor store shelves. That may be because my favorite liquor store just moved into a new larger space, so they have room.
Yeah.
So I don't know what you guys are seeing. But it does seem to me that we're seeing, you know, more available on the retail shelves.
What has always kind of baffled me is that I'm not a big Scotch drinker at home. Like, I'm not going to go drop the $70 to $120 on a bottle to throw at my house. It's just me, right? But when I'm out, it's fine. I'll have a drink or two, depending on the situation, whatever. That's when I usually get into scotch. And it's funny, and Aaron, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, like between Ardmore and Laphroaig, you can get drams of both of those for comparatively inexpensive to your standard Speysides and Highland region, right?
You're actually going to find a pretty broad range for all of these. Just depends on, you know, what exactly you're looking for. I mean, I'm glancing now at one of my favorite whiskey websites, which is Master of Malt. It's hard to compare pricing because, you know, prices are going to vary so much because of state law issues. But, you know, I see Laphroaig bottlings ranging from $40 to, for a fairly common stock item, you know, $120. Similarly, you know, you're going to see even the Speysides, you know, you're going to see the Glenlivet going anywhere from around $40 to, Glenlivet Archive 21, which I actually just recently killed a bottle of. Wonderful stuff, but that was a gift because it's about $160 a bottle. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of variety. I would say the things that we all tried here tonight, ranging probably in price from about $40 to $60, $65, I'm guessing. Anybody spend more than $65 on the bottle?
No,
the Glenmorangie was $45 okay. for me. Yeah.
So most of these were right around, you know, $45,
$50. Valdini was $46 here.
Right. And being in the lovely Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, you know, everything's $14 more than all y'all everywhere else. And it's still accessible. The thing is that because we're state run,
right?
We don't have a huge selection of scotch.
Yeah.
It's gotten better, but they haven't focused on it. So it's either you have your $40 or $50 or $60 bottle. And then maybe two or three in that $70 range. And then everything else is like $120 or above. Right, it's like your Macallan 21.
They're the expensive special edition things that they keep, you know, behind the counter under lock and key because people come in and get them as gifts and things like that.
Actually, they don't keep it under the counter lock and key, which surprises me.
Huh. Yeah, because I mean, I'm looking, even the 16-year-old Lagavulin that I'm drinking is, you know, listed for about $56 a bottle. Which isn't bad at all.
Right, and that's kind of, I mean, that was half kind of what I was saying. I almost grabbed the bottle of Laphroaig today before we came home and did this. And it was like $45. And the Fiddick, which I had, I looked, it was a $60 bottle. And then there were a few that were, and I don't know if, like you said, it's just the special editions. Like there's a lot of marketing involved. And granted, don't get me wrong, 21, 25 years to put into aging a scotch, you got to get your money back. I get that. So the 120, that's not bad. But we have such a differential here. It's crazy.
Yeah. No, it can be hard. And I do recommend, I mean, I mentioned it before sort of in passing, but one of my favorite things about scotch is that it's not like even, you know, vodka or rum that you tend to buy a bottle and, you know, you use it, right?
Right.
You know, make different vodka drinks or you buy the rum and then you make a bunch of Mai Tais or whatever you're going to do. With scotch, you know, I'll buy a bottle, I'll have a couple of glasses, you know, maybe the next, you know, month or two down the road, I might buy another bottle. And what I'm looking for is to sort of, without breaking the bank all at once, you know, have some options to choose from and, you know, bounce between. Because I'm really enjoying the Lagavulin tonight, but I can tell you that there are nights where I'd like to have a scotch, but the, you know, the iodine and peat flavors from the Lagavulin are not what I'm looking for.
Right. And that's, you bring up a really good point that's, that's kind of the way to attack this, is if you want to get into Scotch, okay, say this, whatever your alcohol budget is, I don't know, whatever. But let's say once a month I'm going to buy a bottle, and it's going to be between $60 and $90. That's it. And it turns into this, okay, I'm going to have one of these, or maybe two, and that's it. And if I'm going to drink anything after that, I'm going to pull out the bottle of Woodford Reserve or whatever, some bourbon or some other whiskey, or go on to something else down the road.
Right.
As opposed to, yeah, I'm going to continue with this $70 bottle of Scotch.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're not going to just keep pouring it down, you know, until it's empty. You're going to drink a little bit here, a little bit there, and
right,
kind of go over time.
But it's a good thing, because over 3 or 4 or 5 months, you can have 5 or 6 options on your shelf.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
The other thing that we've kind of done that we kind of enjoy is, with the fact that it's Christmas present, friends of mine that may not have that same Scotch budget, we try to get together every 2 or 3 months, everybody bring what they have, and we'll sit down and try, oh, I haven't had the Balvenie, you try that, you bring the Lagavulin, and I'll try that, we'll swap.
Oh,
and that way you get to try something else that maybe your buddy has.
Yeah, that's a great opportunity. Nice way to do that. All right, well, we should talk a little bit about where you can find good Scotch at Walt Disney World, because that was the other piece of this, was that I sort of, you know, accidentally discovered that there are more good places for Scotch at Walt Disney World than I expected, including some that offer, you know, really nice options for Scotch flights, where you can try, you know, several different Scotches. So just going through sort of I would call this a top 10 list of Walt Disney World restaurants that offer, you know, more than 3 or 4 different single malt scotches to choose from. And that list includes Morimoto Asia, Shula's Steakhouse, the Hotel Lobby Lounge at the Dolphin, Kimono's, also at the Dolphin, Fulton's Crab House, Hollywood Brown Derby. As Bob was just saying in the chat room, yes, Rose and Crown is on that list. Le Cellier, the Bellevue Lounge, which is at Boardwalk Resort, and Yachtsman Steakhouse. All of them have pretty good variety of Scotch. In addition, Flying Fish has a Scotch flight that's on their dessert menu. And I was really surprised at Walt Disney World to discover that these Scotch flights are remarkably reasonably priced. You know, Flying Fish is not an inexpensive restaurant, but you can get a Scotch flight that includes a Glenkinchie Lowland 12-year, the Lagavulin 16-year, Island Park 25-year for $35.
That's not bad at all. I think I paid $21.50 for a tequila flight at La Cava.
Yeah.
Okay. Or something like that. It's manageable.
And you can get a similarly priced flight at Rose and Crown. I was just trying to pull up the pricing, and the website here is being a little slow, so I'll find it. But I want to say it's in the similar price range, and again, another one that's available at Yachtsman Steakhouse. So, you know, there are a number of places, and the nice thing about those flights is, blessing and curse, I guess, a little bit, because it feels a little more pricey, but you know, they're not full pours. They're kind of short pours a little bit, but realistically, if you're going to sit there and drink 3 scotches, you really don't want 3 full pours.
You don't want.
I really agree with that. Yeah,
I do.
It's going to take you a while anyway to get through it.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, my favorite, I love, and I stumbled on this by accident, but you know, a Scotch flight at Rose and Crown during Illuminations, one of my favorite Walt Disney World experiences ever. Just awesome.
21 minutes to get through a Scotch flight, huh?
Okay, so I started before the show. I lingered after.
Dude, I wasn't. I'm like, that's impressive. We're good. I would have had like 4. I would have been to and from the beer cart by then, and had, you know, 2 Guinness, a Bass, and a La Fin de Moon from Canada, because I wanted to go for a walk. So,
so after Illuminations, the stroller's for David.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, That's what Epcot's for, right?
I'm sorry, there was another one that I hadn't realized. The selection isn't quite as good, and there's more blends in there than I would prefer, but Raglan Road has a decent selection of scotches, which I guess makes a certain amount of sense. And Jock Lindsay's has a Scotch Flight.
Does it? How's that one?
You know, it's pretty basic, actually, mm-hmm. looking at it. But they're pretty generous pours, and it's inexpensive. I mean, it's $14.25 for their Scotch Flight. And it's a 12-year Macallan, a 12-year Highland Park, and a 12-year Bowmore.
That's not horrible. That's pretty decent.
The Brown Derby Flight is a Macallan flight. You know, it's a single mm-hmm. distillery flight. So they do the 12-year, the 15-year, and the 18-year for mm-hmm. $22.50.
It's not bad at all. I mean, you compare that to the fact that you can go and get a draft beer for $8.50 or $7.50, depending on what you get. You can go and get a mixed drink for anywhere, anymore. I mean, heck, it's what, $8 to $12?
Pretty much.
For a mixed drink. And you can get a flight for $14.50 at Jock Lindsay's of some pretty decent scotches.
Yeah.
At least they're all single malts, right?
3-4 ounce pour or a 3/4 ounce pour, yeah. So.
That's crazy.
Yeah, pretty good stuff.
Yeah. So just kind of as an aside, has Bellevue been kicking it up a notch? Like just overall? Because when I was there last summer, beer selections were pretty solid. This is like the fourth time I've heard that bar mentioned.
I think it's just a place that a lot of us overlook. You know, you don't really think mm-hmm. of it. It's a hotel bar and it's not in a park. So it doesn't come up very often. And, you know, we started the Diz Dad's Club convention bar crawl there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a revelation. It was a really comfortable spot and they had great selection, a friendly bartender. As long as CJ wasn't spilling his drink on you, it was great.
that's where I met Dawn and Tony there last summer, and it just worked out that was the best place for us to meet. It's a great space, good service. It was just kind of, like you said, impressive for a hotel bar. You didn't expect it.
Yeah, and I agree. Very comfortable. Very comfortable mm-hmm. place to hang out.
Yeah.
All right. Well. Anybody else have Scotch thoughts as we go around? Justin, have we convinced you to try more Scotch, or are you still a beer and bourbon guy?
Well, let me say this. I'm still a beer and bourbon guy, but I could mix in some Scotch every now and then. if it's good Scotch like this, I'm no more of this blended crap.
I tried to tell you.
There's a reason that bottle's been sitting on that shelf for about 15 years.
Okay, I have to ask this. Does everybody's parents have a bottle of blended Scotch that has been there for as long as you've been conscious of the fact that there was a bottle of liquor in your parents' house?
My aunt and uncle. My uncle drinks Crown like it's going out of style, which is all good. It's fine, because I don't mind that. For holidays, but there's always a bottle of Chivas sitting next to it, and I think they've replaced it. Not sure.
There was a bottle Dewars in my parents' house, my house growing up, and it moved from their house growing up to the house that they're retiring in, and I don't know that it was touched ever in my life except to move it from the house they were in into the house they went to. So... I did have a glass of it once, and that was when I swore I'd never drink Scotch because it was so awful. And then I had the Balvenie.
There you go. So you were one over.
So my only other note on this is that the popularity of Scotch has been going through the roof. And there have been... I read a pretty decent article the other day about the fact that the availability of high-end single malt, even mid-range single malt, is, like, not good and not going to be good for the next 10 years.
Yeah, I saw that article, and it's interesting. We'll have to watch it and see what really happens. And I'm wondering, actually, whether, in the short run at least, it ends up being a good thing, only because and I hadn't thought about this before, but you mentioning that triggers it. I wonder if that might be why we're starting to see more variety on the shelves, just because in order to maintain stock levels, they're having to go with a broader range of distilleries.
Right.
Because, you know, as you were saying, the whole problem here is that they've got to forecast demand 10, 15, 20 years down the road. You know, the 21-year-old Macallan that's on the shelf now, you know, it didn't come out of its distilling process until, 1997.
It's impressive how they can put as much stock in what's going to happen 10 years down the road. I don't know how you look at market trends from here to there and what's going to be cool and what's not going to be cool.
I would guess that it's probably why these are old, well-established scotch makers, because you can't experiment. If you make a bad batch and let it sit for 10, 15 years, you need to know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason that there are only, Campbelltown is a great example. There's a whole region called Campbelltown that at one point had more than 30 distilleries. And over time, it's gone all the way down to 3.
Wow.
It's a region, an island region of Scotland that only has 3 distilleries left. And there's been a lot of that. You know, some of it's been consolidation, but in general, there's just been a drawback. And it's a matter of exactly what I think you're saying. You can't afford to be wrong.
Right. Well, I saw a Japanese scotch today.
Yeah, now it's not technically scotch.
Right, because it's not from Scotland.
From Scotland. And that's important because remember that it's got to be made with, water from Scotland, because that's a big part of where your flavor is coming from. But that said, the Japanese really love their scotch, and I think that this is partially, one of their ways of dealing with the shortage issues. That they've been distilling their own using the same techniques. And I was very tempted. They have some of it on the menu at Kimono's. And I was very tempted to order it. The only reason I didn't is because whatever that ginger cocktail was that I was drinking that night was really good. So I got another one of those.
Nice.
All right. Well, I think we've rambled on after talking scotch for long enough. You've heard our opinions of a few different scotches and of scotch in general. We'd love to hear from you. Do you enjoy scotch while you're at Walt Disney World? Where do you go to get it? Email us at podcast@dizdads.com. Visit our blog, dizdads.com. Tweet us at dizdadspodcast on Twitter, and participate in the discussions in our forums at boards.dizdads.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/dizdadspodcast. I've been Aaron Ripmaster with Bob Chavez.
Drink more scotch.
Justin West.
Happy tasting, everyone.
And Dave Jord.
Hey, good night, all. Oh, that better stay in.
Nice. Nice.
Well, that worked. I had my concerns about how that was going to come out, but I think that played well.
Well, I'm on my third different one, and they all have completely different flavor profiles.
So are you working early tomorrow, Dave?
Yeah, of course.
But I'll tell you how well it worked when I go to stand up.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to stumble upstairs. It's only 11:50. We're good.
I probably should have put my sweatpants on before I started this. That's all right.
Thanks again, guys. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, it was nice to be able to steal my dad's scotch. I drank for all of my Balvenie. I had to go steal his. If we do this again, I got a bottle of the Oban and a Johnny Walker Black. So those are the other two I can participate with.
Well, the Johnny Walker Black is a blend.
Yeah.
It's a decent blend, but it's a blend.
According to the book, it's not.
Yeah, it is.
I'm not saying it's not. I said according to the book, it's not.
What book?
The Ultimate Guide to Whiskey. Become a Definitive Whiskey Expert.
What does it say about the Johnny Walker Black?
It doesn't. Oh, it says blended Scotch whiskey right there on the label.